the history of him and kind of going over why that's important to the scheme of things relative to manuscript evidence. And then after class, I will pass out the final exam. It's multiple choice. There's 46 questions, multiple choice, and then question 47 is a essay question on King James, 300 to 500 word essay. So it's not as bad as you think. I said anywhere between, yeah. If you want to do, no, Tim, you're not allowed to do 1,000. Never mind. Especially if you use run-on sentences and keep saying the same thing over 5 times. Yeah, hopefully you guys have progressed beyond the way you used to write when you're in 5th grade or something like that and tried to fill up a 300-word essay. Okay, so we'll go through King James tonight and then hand out the final exam. So his life, he was born James Charles Stuart, or Steward. He was born in Edinburgh Castle in Scotland, June 19th, 1566. He was baptized Roman Catholic by his mother, Mary Queen of Scots. He ascended the throne at age 1 on July 24th, 1567, when his mother was forced to abdicate. So basically, there was obviously a lot of turmoil going on in even Scotland at the time between the Catholic Church and the Protestant Church, much like there was going on in England. And anyway, they kind of forced Mary out of the queenship or whatever you want to call her. That's his father, not father. His father, Henry Lord Darnley, was murdered in February of 1567, possibly at the hands of his wife, Mary. So you can figure out this lady was pretty brutal and not a friend of the church, not a friend of much anything. And so as an infant, James was rescued basically from being raised by the Catholic Church, and he was raised by a staunch Presbyterian, under a staunch Presbyterian guidance, which would have been similar to the Church of England at the time. And so as a result, the Catholic Church basically hated that fact. And basically, his whole life, James was subjected to plots and counterplots to overthrow the kingship, you know, with 3 or 4 of these occurring between, I don't know what I wrote there, 1600, probably 1603 to 1605 is what I meant, but so pretty early in his reign. And so when he was 19 years old, he witnessed the death of several friends in a plot designed to murder Earl of Mar and bring back control of the Roman Catholic Church, just as an example. For his education, he was a paragon of learning. He learned Greek, Latin, and other language. He had very severe physical ailments. We'll get into some of the details of that later. But he had a very sharp mind, and he was a brilliant king. At age 7, he could read a whole chapter of the Bible in Latin and then translate that into French and then subsequently translate that into English. So most kids are doing good to read a chapter of the Bible at 7, let alone knowing 3 languages well enough to translate it. He became known as the most educated sovereign in Europe in his day, and he said his love of learning was reflected in the fact that if he was a prisoner, if he ever was a prisoner, he desired to be incarcerated in the great library of Oxford University. Marriage and children. He married Anne, who was the second daughter of Frederick II, King of Denmark, on August 20th, 1589, at the ripe old age of 21. He had 8 children. Some of them didn't live to adulthood. Henry, his oldest son, was born in 1594 and lived to, I think, is about 18, 19, something like that. And so as a result, he did not inherit the throne. The second child, Elizabeth, was born August 19, 1596, and died February 13, 1662. Margaret, his third, born December 1598, and died in December 1600. She only lived to two. Charles, who ended up succeeding his father, was born November 19, 1600, and died January 1649. And he was actually murdered when he died. Robert, his fifth child, was born January 18, 1602, and only lived about 3 months. Died May 27th, 1602. They had another stillborn child born in May of 1603. And then May was born April 8th, 1605, and died in September 16th, 1607. She only lived a couple years. And then Sophia, another child, only lived a day. And so you can see, you know, several of his children never made it to adulthood. I think only Elizabeth, Margaret, and Henry died early. Elizabeth and Charles were really the only two that made it to a significant age. And so, you know, probably a lot of that was related to his health, potentially, and sort of the intermarriage of royals and things like that, causing problems with children, too. And so as far as monarchy, he became King James the Sixth of Scotland on July 24th, 1567. And then significantly after that, I guess 24, 25, 26 years later, he became King James the First of England on March 24th. And so for the first time in history, this united the two kingdoms of Scotland and England under a single monarchy, and started what we would call the United Kingdom to this day. And so he died almost 22 years later after becoming King of England on March 27th, 1625. And at that time, Charles, his son, ascended the throne because his first son, like we said, Henry, died at the age of 18. And so his health. James had very poor health most of all of his life. He had very weak legs, often had to be supported when walking. I'm guessing he used canes and things of that nature. He had very limited use of his hands. He required a secretary or chamberlain to do all his writing for him. He suffered from gout, arthritis, and possibly porphyria, which is the royal disease. As a result, he was often weak and bedridden. And furthermore, because he was bedridden, his bedroom kind of became his office, and he often had all his courtiers in the, you know, bedroom, probably had a desk and all kinds of stuff in there. And basically, that's where he did his business, was in his bedroom because of that. As a result of all these infirmities, he didn't sleep well. He would often awake in the night. He'd have some of his courtiers read Bible to him or whatever, try to get back to sleep. If he couldn't, he'd start working. He also had an overlarge tongue that made him to drool. He had bouts of pain that often left him delirious. And so, in general, he was physically very repulsive. You know, it's not somebody you'd want to make best friends with if you were looking at him. And so, you know, he could have led a miserable life and just, you know, had a mean, foul spirit like many men in his condition, but instead he let that condition overcome him, and he let the Spirit of God control his life, and he became one of the kindest and best-tempered of men as a result. And so now to kind of talk about his temperament of how he acted, how he conducted himself. He was noted for having a very kind temper. He was just, you know, in general, especially for a king, very kind-hearted. Bishop Godfrey Goodman described James by saying, "Hereunto you may add the carriage and disposition of King James. Truly, I never know any man of so great an appreciation, of so great love and affection, a man so truly just, so free from all cruelty and pride, such a lover of the church, and one who had done so much for the church. And so, also Sir Henry Wotton of James, wrote of James in 1602, saying, "There appears a certain natural goodness verging on modesty. Among his good qualities, none shines more brightly than the chasteness of his life, which he has preserved without stain to the present time, contrary to the example of almost all his ancestors, who disturbed the kingdom with great number of bastards which they left." And, you know, you kind of compare somebody like this to Henry VIII or something that was divorcing his wives left and right and just, you know, wreaking havoc on the kingdom. You know, here you got a godly man that has a good spirit. He's you know, not prideful like most kings. He's very meek and modest and willing to do anything for anybody. So a great contrast there. Sir Roger Wilbraham stated in 1603, "The king is of the sharpest wit and invention, of the sweetest, most pleasant, and best nature that I ever knew, desiring nor affecting anything but true honor. Also, he was not a coward and could display considerable nerve in the face of danger." And that's shown in the fact of how he handled a lot of these assassination attempts on his life and just some very, very bad circumstances coming through his life. I mean, he could have, you know, just wallowed away and kind of just hid away and did nothing, but instead he still kept a public life. He still was out there in front of his people because he cared about his subjects. Hugh Walpole tells us he had large, prominent blue eyes, and they stared at the person with whom he talked as though he would read all secrets. You know, and I've seen people like that, you know, that they have such a walk with God that they can almost stare through you and know what you're thinking, and you get a little bit, lack of better word, spooked by them sometimes because they have such a walk with God, and that kind of sounds like what he had. Stephen A. Costin Sr. stated his profane liberality, which sprang from the same source, was chief, if not the sole cause, of his constant want of money. So, you know, basically, he was so generous that he never had any money left. You know, anybody would come to him asking for something, he'd pretty much try to meet the need if he could. You know, he was just a very generous man, as well as being kind. And so another thing that was important to him was leaving a legacy to his sons. And, you know, in some ways, I would, you know, a lot of, you know, and we'll get into this, but they likened him to the Solomon of Britain. And I would argue in a lot of ways he was even way more godly king than Solomon. You know, he kind of tried to leave a legacy with his heirs and tried to teach them. You know, and Solomon tried to teach his sons too, but it seemed like some of it stuck more with his kids. But, you know, if you kind of took everything of every good king in the Old Testament and tried to put them in together into one king, it would have been King James, basically, is the way I would describe it. He promoted masculinity and despised the effeminate. And we'll find out why that's important later. He authored a book called The Basculin Doran, or translated, The Kingly Gift, for his son Henry for when he was to take the throne prior to his untimely death. And so obviously that went to Charles. He stated in this book, "But especially eschew to be effeminate in your clothes, in perfuming, preening, or such like. And make not a fool of yourself in disguising or wearing long hair or nails, which are but excrements of nature." So, you know, you say, why would somebody be, well, back then, wearing long hair and doing a lot of this stuff, guys were doing it and taking on sort of effeminate qualities. And obviously, he was not in favor of queers either, so because of that, he would despise them. Of the vices of prosperity, he wrote, our peace hath bred wealth, and peace and wealth hath brought forth a general sluggishness, which makes us wallow in all sorts of idle delights and soft delicacies. The first seeds of subversion are of all great monarchies. And so he's saying, like, you know, he sees the evils of wealth, and, you know, much like we have in this country to this day, or today, you know, having a lot of things leads to idleness and sluggishness and just a general evil that pervades, and sort of all the soft delicacies. But, you know, this was especially true of the monarchies and the royal families and stuff, that, you know, they get used to living easy, and it affects the way they think, the way they write laws, the way they treat their subjects. And, you know, that general mentality pervaded the monarchy in England especially. Also, he was against tobacco, even writing a treatise entitled A Counterblast to Tobacco. He was several hundred years ahead of his time on the evils of smoking, long before we had the American Lung Association or whatever it is. Amen. In Basilian Doran, he had advised his heir, there are some horrible crimes that ye are bound in, conscious never to forgive, such as witchcraft, willful murder, incest, and sodomy. So, you know, he was against sodomy, he was against incest, he's against, you know, murder and witchcraft, and made a strong stand on those. He also believed a man should be a virgin before he marries, and believed the body was the temple of the Holy Spirit, and vain allurements lead men astray. He did not believe that being a monarch gave a person a license to sin, but felt it was ever more important for a ruler to be without fault. He believed that, and this was kind of a premise of it, he said, holiness being the first and most requisite quality of Christian, as proceeding from true fear and knowledge of God. And so, you know, he believed in holy living, and believed in a fear of God, and holiness, like we would. He was referred to as the British Solomon. King James was referred to as the British Solomon. He was not just knowledgeable of politics, but also of academics and theology. So much like Solomon had a lot of wisdom, King James was very much like that. He had a devout interest in the Word of God. He wanted the Bible to be in the hands of the people. And at his funeral, Bishop Williams compared King James to Solomon in no less than 11 particulars during preaching his funeral. So this shows that this was a great godly king. Then as a Christian, so James was not just a king, he was a devout Christian first and foremost. Said, in regards to ruling, he stated in Basilian Doran, God gives not kings the style of gods in vain, for on his throne his scepter do the sway. So kings should fear and serve their God again. If they would enjoy a happy reign, observe the statutes of your heavenly king, and from his law make all your laws to spring. And so you shall in princely virtues shine, resembling right your mighty king divine. And so he did not believe that some rulers, like some rulers, that a king is answerable to no one, but he believed that they were answerable to God. He felt that a king is twice obligated to God, once as a Christian and second as a sovereign. And so he realized this dual responsibility to God was very important, and that's how he ran his kingdom. He realized that first and foremost he was responsible to God, and then he was responsible for how he ran his kingdom or how he acted as a sovereign. And he took that very seriously. He believed in salvation by grace through faith and a prayer life. He said in Basilian Doran again, now faith is the free gift of God, as Paul saith. It must be nourished by prayer, which is no thing else but a friendly talking to God. Use oft to pray when ye are quiet, especially on your bed. And so much like the psalm said, he prayed on his bed, you know, because he didn't have a lot of choice. But, you know, he had a strong fellowship with God. You know, you can tell from reading this. And he had a strong faith in God, and he believed in the free gift of God, of salvation in Jesus Christ. And though he was a Presbyterian, he enrolled his heir, Prince Philip, in Magdalen College at Oxford, which decidedly had a Puritan bent. So he was very friendly with the Puritans. He kind of thought like a Puritan. He even spoke of the corruptions of the Church of England, and Lancelot Andrews, who was one of the lead translators of the King James Bible, said of him, he did wonderfully play the Puritan. So even though he wasn't a Puritan, he acted like one, is basically what he was saying. He knew his Bible well and could quote it well. He felt that the common man should have access to the Bible. And so as one of his first acts of becoming King of England, he commissioned a new translation of the Bible into English so it would be available primarily to all his subjects. So he didn't just get the Bible translated. He set up all the printing apparatus to make it happen, too, to make sure that Bible got in the hands of the people. And so he wanted a Bible that was easily understood by the people of his day. He just didn't want another translation of the Latin or something like that. Relative to the New World, so he wanted to establish colonies in the New World because he wanted to carry the gospel to the Native Americans. And so unlike the King of Spain and France, he was not concerned with filling his coffers, but carrying the gospel to America with the establishment of the Virginia colony. So if you remember your American history, the Virginia colony started under King James's rule. And so he was very influential in making that happen and guiding how that happened. The accomplishments of King James. Though men like Christopher Columbus, the Wright brothers, Henry Ford, Thomas Edison all made great discoveries that affected lives, they did not change or alter history like King James. England was not the only one who benefited from the king, but so did America, Canada, Australia, India, and every other nation that flew the British flag. And so here are some of his accomplishments. He united the nations of England, Ireland, and Scotland to form what we now call the British Empire or the United Kingdom. He commissioned the translation of the authorized version of the Bible. He established the first Christian colony in the New World and provided the foundation for the United States to be built upon Christianity, not religion. And so, you know, you think about the pilgrims, they came over about right at this time he became king. And you could say, well, England was kicking the pilgrims out of England. Yeah, I get that. But at some level, he had influence in that and at least made sure they had a place to go. He developed the concept of trial by jury that then became the standard of Western civilization, including the United States. And also, he started to exalt womanhood and the sanctity of marriage. For example, when he married his wife Anne, he spent 15 days in prayer and meditation before marrying her, coming to that decision. So it wasn't something that he took lightly relative to marriage. Now let's talk about the enemies of King James. So the Roman Catholic Church, there was multiple attempts to take over the throne from his wicked mother to start with, and that failed. There was also the gunpowder plot that we talked about before where they tried to kill him. And then the Spanish ambassador to England said in 1607, he is a Protestant. The king tries to extend his Protestant religion to the whole island. The king is a bitter enemy of our religion, Roman Catholicism. He frequently speaks of it in terms of contempt. So in other words, he didn't mince words. He is all the harsher because of this last conspiracy, the gunpowder plot, against his life. He understood that the Jesuits had a hand in it. So Who's going to love somebody when they try to assassinate them as a king? You know, I mean, it's like, what did they expect? But, you know, so in other words, their attempted failure cost them dearly and, you know, probably set back the Catholics for decades, if not hundreds of years, in their attempt to Catholicize the Church of England. The opponents of the monarchy. So there was animosity of the monarchy in England at the time James came to the throne. Within 25 years of his death, the English Civil War under Oliver Cromwell led to the execution of his son, Charles. So, you know, even when he took over, there was a lot of rumblings, and that continued on under his son. And you can imagine a country going from a wicked, you know, ruler like Henry VIII and a lot of his predecessors to a godly king like this, and the uniting of, you know, two to three countries and all the good that came out of this, that's going to stir up the devil and these people that were in the country that wanted to do wicked. And so there was a lot of rumblings to the point it actually started a civil war in England after his death. So this was in an age when there were few kings that could please their subjects. Even though he did a lot of good, you know, there were still people complaining about all kinds of stuff. And even though his subjects still loved James, even though there all this bad was going on, his subjects still loved him. Next of all, there was an anti-Scottish racism or something of that nature. So James was a Scot, and now he was reigning over England. And in general, England, especially at this time, did not look on the Scots at the time and well, and were racist against them. I don't know if I can get an analogy, but you know, it's almost like a black man becoming governor of Georgia in 1860 or something like that was the analogy that Brother Gipp used. You know, English did not like the Scots, you know, and they had a profound racism for them. I mean, some of the things, I'm not even going to repeat what Dr. Gipp wrote in the book about them. You know, they just totally hated them. So you can imagine a Scot reigning in England at this time. And so so the Scots to this day, you know, in some places of the country still look down the English still look down on the Scots in certain parts of mainland England to this day. And so King James, when he came to the throne in England, you got to remember he had been reigning in Scotland as king for probably almost 26 years. And so at that point, he had a very established court, you know, people he could trust. And so he brought almost all those people with him in his court and over that 36-year reign in Scotland. And because he left that court almost fully intact, there were very few Englishers. That almost sounds like an Amish thing, but sorry. But there were very few Englishers on his court or in his court, and so that naturally brought a distrust among the English because, you know, his advisors weren't English, and you know, and there was a lot of that going on. Like there was always several courtiers and people that influenced the king, like you would expect. And so the English kind of felt like they'd been removed from, you know, the royal class there. And so there were several men who wrote very racist things against the Scots and King James, calling the Scots terrible things. And so these disgruntled men, you know, as time went by, committed things to writing, and, you know, for the most part at the time, you know, people pretty much ignored those because they knew what King James was really like. But, you know, if you got Bible correctors and Bible haters, they're going to dig up whatever kind of trash they can dig up, and that's what's happened, you know, in this day. So you got these three men, Anthony Weldon, Francis Osborne, and Edward Peyton. And so, you know, well after King James was dead, even his son, they wrote some stuff down and some pretty bad stuff. So Anthony Weldon, who hated Scots, wrote a treatise entitled The Perfect Description of the People and Country of Scotland. So you can imagine what he said in there. And so that was printed after James's death in 1659, even after his son Charles's death. And so he was basically a slanderer of King James. And while King James was alive, I believe Weldon may have been on his court or something but that like that. And so King James dismissed Weldon probably rather than having him quartered. And, you know, still let him live, even though he probably shouldn't have. And in 1650, he wrote this treatise against King James. And so he didn't come right out and say it, but he basically accused King James of sodomy and alluded to King James being an open homosexual. So the king was dead. The men he accused of having sodomy with, you know, weren't around to defend themselves. And so, you know, nobody really got rid of this book, but it survived history to this day. And so at the time, all those charges were disregarded and, you know, basically nobody believed him. However, a new wave of hatred of King James crept into our modern times, and the treatise of Anthony Weldon was resurrected. And so what he claimed, that King James was had an open homosexual relationship with the Earl of Buckingham, commonly referred to as Villiers, because he was trying to make a point, he did not hate the English because he was a Scot, when he said before Parliament, "You may be sure that I love the Earl of Buckingham." Villiers had been raised to peerage more than anyone else and more than you, talking about Parliament, who are assembled. I wish to speak in my own behalf and not to have it thought to be a defect. For Jesus did the same, therefore I cannot be blamed. Christ had his John, and I have my George, referring to George Villiers. And so, you know, he was trying to make a point that he had this Englishman that was probably his best friend, much like sharing the same relationship that Jesus Christ and John had, showing how close it was. And so, you know, but they obviously took that the wrong way. And so if King James was a homosexual based on this statement, then Weldon is also accusing Jesus Christ of being a homosexual, basically. So you can see how outlandish some of this stuff is. Other men, Francis Osborne, he considered the Scots wily, beggarly, rabble, and possessor of nothing but eggs, barnacles, and drugs. Edward Peyton ranked with the worst of them with his hatred of the Scots. So you can see this underlying animosity of Scots and distrust of the king pervaded the kingdom while James was ruling. Okay, so the claims of homosexuality disputed. The claims, many of the enemies of the King James in this day and age will go to any length to destroy the Bible. So they've dug up these works by Weldon and now spread them as truth. They make the claim that King James was an open homosexual, and because of that, there is no way the King James Bible is any good. We will now examine several reasons why King James could not have been a homosexual, in addition to the previous things we discussed about his hatred of the effeminate and his views on marriage and fornication. First of all, we have his public reaction. So if King James were truly an open homosexual, as Weldon claimed after his death, there would have been a public reaction to it at the time. You know, in that day and age of the Puritan, they probably would have killed him easily. I mean, if they killed Mary, Queen of Scots, for being Catholic, they certainly would have killed King James for being a queer. There would have been also public outcry. You know, if this was true, our history books would be full of letters, tracts, and books written against this sin. And also, the upstanding citizens of that time would have written about it while he was on the throne and alive, and it wouldn't have shown up, you know, 20, 30 years later in some obscure book by some guy that hated his guts to start with. And then there's no way, if he was an open homosexual, it would not have been documented everywhere. I mean, it's just beyond comprehension. Also, he had a cooperation with the Puritans. The Puritans never would have agreed to help a homosexual king translate the Bible. And so, as you remember last week when we were talking about the translators, many of those translators, like Lancelot Andrews and others, were Puritans. There's no way they would have sat on that committee if they knew he was an open homosexual. And also, the Puritans were just way too strict to have went along with the king and have been friends with him. You know, his son being basically in a Puritan school, things of that nature. Also, the Anglicans wouldn't have put up with it. You know, the king was basically the head of the Church of England, much like the Pope was the head of the Catholic Church. And they never would have had a queer running the Church of England. Even to this day, the Church of England is not in favor of ordaining openly homosexual priests. So, you know, if you figure 400 and whatever years later, if they wouldn't put up with it today, there's no way they would have put up with it back then. Then you have the Bible translators. So the translation committee, like I said, was made up of Anglicans and Puritans. The Puritans were the more Bible-oriented of the two groups, obviously, but neither would have accepted a blatant homosexual request to translate the Bible. Also, you have the epistle dedicatory at the beginning of the Bible. Would not have said of a homosexual king, "Great and manifold were the blessings, most dreaded sovereign, with Almighty God, the Father of mercies, bestowed upon us, the people of England, when first he sent your majesty's royal person to rule and reign over us." You know, you wouldn't say those kinds of things of a queer. And then some have claimed that the epistle dedicatory was just a political posture, but how could a group put the name of a pervert on the front of their Bible? It makes absolutely no sense. And then we have the pilgrims. And so, you know, like I said before, the pilgrims obviously were coming over almost at the exact time King James took the throne. And throughout the charter that they wrote, the pilgrims refer to both God and King James in terms of adoration and praise in the Mayflower Compact. These people were unwanted in Europe and sought a new home for religious purposes. They had nothing to lose and would not have written the compact as such. So, you know, basically they were divorced from England. You know, why would they have written stuff like that if they were under political influence? And then God. And so after its publication, the King James Bible found its way around the world. Foreign missions were started from England, and they were kicked off by this Bible. There were several great translations before the King James, and God could have used any of them. However, God chose a humble king for his Bible to be translated and carried around the world. God obviously did not think King James was a homosexual. Sorry. So, I know this was kind of crude, but that's where modern Bible scholars are at, unfortunately. And so, you kind of see the contrast of what King James was really like versus what modern Bible translators try to make him out to be. Any questions?